Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike Vassaf, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest this week is Janet Bailey, principal at No Chaff Group. No Chaff Group is focused on providing consulting services to growers and agribusinesses in the areas of rural brand management and mental health, social governance, advocacy strategy, and other financial services. In this episode, Janet shares insights and lessons learned from her three decades in the industry, spanning a childhood growing up on a dairy farm during the 1980s farm crisis, as the marketing development lead for Kansas Association of Wheat Growers, and nearly 20 years at Frontier Farm Credit as their VP for Marketing and Communications. We get into a whole host of issues, including her experiences and the value of mentorship, early technology adoption on their farm, the nuanced and often dangerous way that we dispense advice over social media today, and her story as a breast cancer survivor. Janet's developmental initiatives around the veteran community and ag labor needs is absolutely something you should reach out to Janet about if you're interested in learning more or partnering with No Chaff Group. Enjoy.
My background in agriculture and in production agriculture might be similar to some people who grew up in the 1980s, especially, and we found ourselves in a time of great change in the industry and really didn't think about pursuing a career in agriculture. Despite that upbringing, I grew up on a dairy farm, so we had a diversified crop operation, dairy cows, bucket calves, actually fed 100 bucket calves in 1985 to divert our milk into those calves and raise them. So, you know, we had a robust operation. We backgrounded steers as well, and even had feeder pigs. So all of that created, I think my sisters would agree, we were raised with a strong work ethic. I don't know that a lot of people in the 1980s in our generation saw ourselves going into agriculture. And in fact, friends older than myself who did get agriculture degrees didn't find a lot of jobs in the mid-1980s. I graduated almost a decade later, and jobs in agriculture were plentiful. And were it not for my dad and some of his friends who really mentored me, I probably would have taken a path outside of agriculture. But I was really fortunate, and I think it speaks to the value of mentoring and reaching out to people, that I had a great opportunity through college to be mentored and work in several agricultural trade associations and have some wonderful collegiate experiences at the Land Grant Institution. And but for that, who knows, but I've been in agriculture about three decades now.
Why do you think it was so challenging at that point in the mid-1980s for agricultural professions? Did it have to do with external circumstances or factors, or was it something specific to the dairy industry?
You know, it definitely was a product of the 1980s farm crisis. And I think we could probably spend several podcasts and have guests that would elaborate on that. But fundamentally, the economics of agriculture were not good. The socioeconomic pathway that a lot of my friends experienced was not one that they wanted to replicate in their lives going forward. So when you saw that exit from agriculture, that didn't create a sense of opportunity for people. Thankfully, by the time I went to college in the early 1990s, companies were recruiting again. They were hiring. People were bullish on agriculture. And so for my peers, it created real opportunity. But I think that those of us who are sensitive to and who've listened to the stories of our friends who didn't go to work in maybe companies, agricultural companies they would have liked to, but thankfully still stayed in the industry, whether it was in production agriculture or stayed in some type of connection to the industry. I think we are sensitive when we see those cycles of agriculture to understand that we want to create opportunity for the generations to come back, because agriculture is cyclical. There will be ups and downs, but we will always need talent, and we've got to find a way to create that opportunity and navigate those difficult discussions.
What kinds of things were those early mentors telling you that, you know, kind of caused you to stay in the industry despite what you experienced through the 80s?
My mentors were especially focused in the variety of talents that we need in the industry. So I was a journalism and communication student. I studied political science as well as production agriculture. So I had all of those interests, and I had a lot of encouragement to apply myself and to just learn as much and gain as much experience as I could. There was less emphasis then than what there is now on study abroad and some of the international experiences. But I think we can look today and understand how important it is to have a diverse set of experiences, regardless of what segment of the industry you would like to work in. You know, further, technology was something we knew was important to agriculture, but I think that our friends in the military were far ahead of knowing how that was going to influence the industry. And I can look back now and recognize that my friends who went into the military or who are still in the military, or further, those who are out of the military and working at ag tech, they have a phenomenal set of skills, and I learn from them all the time.
Can you recall, as a young girl growing up, any technologies that you guys were using on the dairy operation at the time? And then as you look back on it, how it sort of progressed?
Sometimes when you're using something, you don't identify it as technology. So I think about the first time that we got a four-wheel drive pickup, because if we needed something with horsepower or with pulling power, we had to get a tractor. Four-wheel drive pickups became more common, and so we could actually use a four-wheel drive pickup instead of a tractor. We used magnetic feeders. So if a cow needed additional supplement of feed, she'd wear a chain around her neck and she could walk into a special feeder. That metal would hit the magnet and it would release additional feed for her. So that was the precursor now to feed that through, you know, computer technology will feed a ration or pounds, you know, needed per animal. So those are two important things that we utilized. My dad and I were interested in the growth of technology and what that meant for the industry. And he was a leader in dairy cooperatives. So some of the technology he was looking at was for the benefit of the producer to get that milk to the marketplace. And so consumer trends and how the dairy cooperative could benefit more of its members by using consumer data.
Yeah, I think that's often even today one that doesn't necessarily get the value on it that it certainly can is the data that's produced through these different forms of technology and that's gathered at the producer level, how it can be used to influence different production decisions. And how much, quote, value it has. Is that a monetary value? Is it some kind of insightful-based value? I mean, that's certainly something that I think producers still struggle with today of, I've got all this information. How can I make it work to my benefit? Does it belong to me? Is it something I can lever, et cetera? So yeah,
I think a good example of that, we raised and milked Holstein cows, and that was predominantly what was raised where I grew up in Kansas. But we knew we could feed them a higher fat ration, and through bypass protein, they would produce milk that had a higher fat content. And that was a desirable component in the milk. And when you're paid on the components in milk, you want that component. So in essence, understanding that and the technology derived from research that created a better feed ration allowed us to feed the cows to produce the type of milk that would yield a greater paycheck on the farm. Yeah. So, you know, technology is a broad term, and we can use it to describe a variety of things. I think that the technology that we can look at now that I'm really excited about us being able to employ in rural America, you know, will be something that my kids look at these comments that I've shared and think, Mom, how could you think that a four-wheel drive pickup was technology? Well, you know what? If you've ever been stuck in a pasture, think about if you didn't have a four-wheel drive pickup, and that's the value. Technology has to bring value to people. That's where the rubber meets the road.
There was one thing you mentioned earlier on this sort of cyclical nature of the ag space and, you know, the issues in the community in the 80s. I'm wondering if you see any parallels between, you know, the farm crisis of that point and the succession issues that producers are facing today. I mean, do you see yourself as now the mentor talking to folks who may be looking at leaving the space because of what's happening with succession? I mean, can you kind of tie any of those similarities together?
I can, and it's humbling. I'm not sure at what point any of us realize that we're in the mentorship role, but I think there's a reality that we don't ever outgrow the need for a mentor either. And I still want to be mentored. So I seek out people who can help me, guide me, pour into me. You know, I need that mentorship. At the same time, I have people who seek counsel from me or who refer people to me. And I think this succession piece of this is playing out in a lot of different ways, because we have interpersonal relationships, and then we have this fragmented pseudo interpersonal relationship that we get through social media. Mm-hmm. And people are kind of comfortable making assumptions about others or taking advice from people that they very thinly know. So I think it's very important as we assume a role of mentoring others, that we bring a level of authenticity and at the same time, create a different framework than we had years ago, because the influences into people in agriculture, in communications, governmental relations, reputation, management, those worlds I work in as well, are ones that are not as narrowly defined anymore. So it's really important that those of us who are in that space working together, or as you and I have talked about in the space with veterans and rural issues, that we have a really robust place for knowledge exchange. And we invite some people to the table, and it's great to challenge assumptions and ask questions. We also have to recognize that has to be done in a very respectful and responsible way. That's the type of mentoring I think that we are hungry for today.
Talk to us, Janet, about what your early, you know, 20s and your early career was like. I mean, you talked about financial services. You've obviously got a flair and a background for public relations and communications, but give us a sense for what that early career was like for you.
My early career was a mix in a national seed brand. And then I had the opportunity to do some work toward my master's in agricultural economics. That was cut short by the glory of being recruited towards civil service. And I had a couple classmates from the master's program who were pretty successful in showing me an opportunity to go to work in state government. It was a fabulous time in my career. I learned a lot and hopefully contribute a lot through that time. Working in economic development, both agricultural economic development, and then also spreading into rural development, business recruitment, some of the housing policy that's very important to rural communities. And then from that, I moved back into agricultural producer associations and spent time helping to develop opportunities for producers to advance their objectives.
Can you, and maybe this is just from me as a veteran, we often communicate, and I'm sure you know this as well, just through story. It just tends to be the way that we talk to each other. Can you give us a story from that early career, either in policy or at the state government level, or as you moved into finance, that you've experienced something that really sticks with you today?
You know, there's a story, and it comes from the era of 9/11, and that week was pretty monumental for me. I was actually supposed to be on an airplane headed somewhere to work on some wheat industry policy on some trade issues. And I also learned that week that I was pregnant with my second child. And on 9/11, I was in a bioscience hearing at our state house that morphed over that day into a bioterrorism hearing. And so those were actually issues, public policy issues that were in my portfolio that I worked. One of the legislators that I worked with at the time was a really compassionate individual. And I guess I would say so many legislators truly are compassionate. They want to do right by those who elect them to serve in the state house. This individual happened to be from Western Kansas. And I remember, you know, he was older, and just, you know, his patriotism, his concern at so many different levels in that day. And we had great conversation, you know, throughout the day during breaks, what have you. Later that winter, my board of directors was in town for an event, and that legislator pulled one of my board members aside and said, "I want you to know something about her." You know, and as a staff member that works for a board, you always think, okay, this could go a lot of different ways, right? And he said, "I want you to know something about her. She will always tell me the whole story of an issue. I won't be surprised. I know what the other side is going to tell me, and it helps me make a decision. And I want you to know, I appreciate that." And throughout my career, I have always tried to be somebody who will lay out the facts so that there aren't any surprises, so that if there is a lawmaker, if there's somebody of influence, that they aren't surprised. And, you know, I think when I've worked with veterans as well, and we've talked about whether it's public policy that's needed or different initiatives that we want to collectively see advanced, I think it's so important to do a situation analysis, because we don't want those surprises. We don't want to be disappointed, but we also want to have really good strategy. And I don't know how you build good strategy without knowing where your problems are going to be or where the challenges are going to be. And that candor is something that they have seemed to appreciate, and I certainly appreciate as well. But it's that lawmaker in the back of my head who's pulling my board member aside often, who's preaching that.
We've talked a little bit about it kind of on the periphery, but let's maybe bring it to the center of the conversation here with your work with the veteran community. Can you describe how that originally came to pass for you and why it was an area that you felt like you wanted to be involved with?
It was convergence of a lot of things. I'm really thankful for that. And we saw within the industry and then nationally that there were some opportunities with emerging groups. And so I live near a military town. Our farm was under the flight path of the helicopters at times. So I'm certainly no stranger to the Army, and folks who know a map of Kansas know that there were a lot of bases, a lot of frontier forts and still some bases in our state. So that gives you a good idea of where I grew up. You know, you pile that onto some of the incentives and some of the needs of the Army and the needs of agriculture, and the convergence was absolutely there. So I was involved with some other people in bringing forward the Farmer Veteran Coalition chartering in Kansas. And, you know, from that, we've had different engagement involvement. There have been a couple other special veteran groups or farm advocacy type veteran groups form as well that I was a part of during my time in financial services. Right now, I'm looking at some opportunities in terms of ag labor and how can we support people with military experience going directly into agricultural opportunities. You know, we have such a strong need for agricultural labor across the United States, and that looks very different coast to coast, but the needs are varied from, you know, people to step on farms and work to agribusiness. And so elevating that conversation is something that is really important to me in this season.
Can you elaborate on the specific kinds of ag employment you're looking at targeting for the veteran community? Or is that still something that's kind of in development?
Yeah, it's something in development. And so we're looking for additional partners for that conversation. But we absolutely know that agriculture tech is part of that space. We still have a need for ag employees who can work on farm, operating machinery, mm-hmm. making repairs, folks who have common sense and a solid work ethic who would absolutely love to live in a remote area of the United States. So the need is broad, and I think the challenge has been there are veteran groups who have that dialogue, and we need more agricultural producers who can help to complete that puzzle, because we're still not able to have the pipeline to get folks into the places where we need labor, and we've got to elevate that to a way that creates real results. And it's through nobody's fault, because it's just a challenge. It is an absolute challenge to have the right pathways to do that. So I think we've got to enhance that conversation.
What does the practical pathway look like, do you think? Or what are some options that you're exploring? Are these, you know, online marketplaces, or these social groups, are these internship initiatives? I mean, what kinds of things do you think would work in this situation, practically speaking?
I think from a practical, very practical standpoint, when a farmer wants to hire anybody, there becomes a lot of questions that they ask. And I think we've looked at this from a veteran onboarding standpoint, but I do question, and I want to have this conversation with more people in the veteran community, have we looked at this from the farmer standpoint so that we can understand and create a dialogue, not because I want to make this farmer centric, but because I want for us to have a great pathway. So the farmer gets the type of employee they're looking for. And so that if it's a veteran, they go in without surprises, and both of them have a shared understanding and a shared experience. Because I think until we get that type of conversation, we're just at an impasse. So those are the types of things I think we've really got to work through and have that dialogue with the prospective employers, and employers who are willing to say, I'm going to invest in this, even though I only hire people X times a year or every other year or whatever their cycle is. You know, we've got to have investors who will create a system on that end so that we have a better way to present agriculture's opportunity set to veterans.
There are too many veterans that come out back to rural communities that lack a network to get settled professionally, personally, medically, into that community. It's just not something that they get a lot of training for in the service. And so with any and every opportunity we can to get them plugged into private practitioners, for example, who happen to maybe be co-located next to bases, I mean, we've got to seize those opportunities.
Well, and I think taking it a step further, I met a colleague locally one afternoon to just talk about some of the big things that are, you know, in this world that we're working on, or the big things that we want to be working on. We're both dreamers and type A personalities. And we happened to get in a conversation with a veteran, and very quickly we realized the things in our very own military community that we thought were there for transitioning people are a real struggle for him to access. And, you know, as business people in this community, and for me, you know, as somebody in agriculture who wants to see as many great people coming from the military come into my industry, that really created a call on my heart to keep pushing on those things I've been working on, regardless of, you know, what we call the initiative. We've got to keep circling the wagons and do better.
Yeah. And I mean, this idea of sort of shared hardships as well, I think, mm-hmm. is something the veteran can relate to with respect to other service members, but it also may be something that they can relate to with agricultural producers as well, through the cyclicality mm-hmm. of the industry. I mean, there are peaks and troughs, so to speak. And I know that, you know, you've had your own sort of significant trials in your life. I mean, can you talk about how those trials have shaped the way that you view your current practice, or the approach that you've taken to the values that you carried through your early career and today?
Well, I hope that I'm a reformed type A personality, although my friends would say I'm a terrible reformed type A personality. But when my kids were in elementary school, I was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer. And of the kinds of breast cancer you can have, that's one of the tougher ones. And, you know, we spoke about technology and the technology curve. Had I been diagnosed probably 5 to 8 years earlier, I probably wouldn't be here today. Research and solutions and treatments are that quick in terms of the development of saving lives. So I went through chemotherapy, reconstruction, lots of surgery, and you know, you don't go through that, or at least I didn't go through that, without being a changed person. Subsequent to that, my kids have had chronic illness, and you know, patience is a muscle, and the only way you build a muscle is to use it. I never would have seen myself as a patient person, and when people, you know, say, oh, you're patient. No, I'm not patient. I'm just determined, and just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And, you know, people who've heard me speak will sometimes remind me in presentations that I've said, there's no such thing as a bad hair day after you've had a no hair day. And I've had those no hair days, right? And so subsequently working with veterans, I probably have greater empathy as well, because there are a lot of experiences that you really can't explain to anybody else. You know, I have my own demons, chemo demons, which are, you know, it's a red devil drug. And so I appreciate that sometimes you just are thankful to move on and move through things. But it also means sometimes we've got to fight a little harder. And there are things that don't come as easily to me today. And I will forever be changed, not only as a human being, but physically, with things that are more difficult for me to do. And that level of empathy transcends a lot. And it creates, I think, more drive in me to make sure that we don't leave people behind in our society.
Having gone through an experience like that, you hear that people's perceptions change, and the things that they value and take for granted or don't take for granted change as well. I mean, do you have a similar experience where, you know, something or some things that were just sort of everyday life for you aren't anymore?
The further I get from that experience, I find myself falling in the trap of what's my normal. You know, this is supposed to be normal. I think our early childhood, however we are raised, right, that's supposed to define normal. It's an important paradigm shift. because normal doesn't exist anymore. I think coming out of a pandemic, right? People are hungry to go back to normal. The supply chain is never going to be like it was prior to 2020. Some of the ways that we do things will never be the same. You know, I can appreciate autoimmune challenges. I can appreciate using hand sanitizer, washing your hands every time you come in the house. I mean, that was so 2010 for me. You know, that was normal, right? My kids had to do that when they came home from school. Walk in the house, wash your hands, then you could go about whatever's normal. So, but we're still wired to want to go back to normal. And I think that we have a high level of accountability to one another to elevate a dialogue and say, okay, where's their opportunity? How are we going to create better pathways in our communities, in industry, among those who have been in the service for what is now? When veterans have those conversations, I really respect that oftentimes they can reflect upon where they may have been deployed. And when you're deployed somewhere, your goal isn't to bring that country or that region back to normal. Your goal is to stabilize, right? So, you know, I'm looking to my veteran friends today saying, hey, what's that look like? How do we stabilize and how do we move forward? How do we make it better? So I'm hungry to sit at the table with veterans and let's get at it. I think that it's easy to characterize agriculture in a certain way. And agriculture is so multidimensional. Right. You know, we still have smallholder farms. We've got complex ag tech enterprises. There are firms who need experts in logistics, especially right now. I mean, the system is very broken and it's going to continue to have challenges in the supply chain, and companies are trying to be very nimble. I have a great deal of respect for organizations that are trying to figure out how to get raw materials in and then turn around and create products when we have got just a very disrupted marketplace. And then you take a lot of the other skills that you learn in the military, whether that's, you know, figuring out how to work together for a common goal, or, you know, some of those skills when you are deployed and you've got to assess a situation. Boy, those are pretty valuable. Whether you're on a farm or ranch, or you're in a corporate environment or a trade association trying to, again, bring people to a common goal. So those opportunities, I think, make us all stronger. This is a great time for us to learn from the resilience of veterans. And I'm very thankful for the veterans who continue to be my friends, who pour into me and who challenge my business assumptions or who help me to create better ones.
I'm curious from your perspective. I mean, do you find it difficult for the veteran to articulate those experiences, to talk about those situations where they, you know, went through something or they had to learn something? I mean, is it a struggle in your experience to get them to say or articulate what that means, or to talk about how that skill is a part of their everyday life? And if it's not, in what form are they generally doing it? Is it through story? Is it through some other medium?
I think what is meaningful to convey is we encourage people, again, you know, in personal branding, right? What's your 30-second elevator speech in personal branding? So I think for a veteran, what is that one or 2 minute example? Yeah. Of being in a situation where you used your skills and abilities to further the mission, or to that you could share that demonstrates your competency. You know, that would work for a trauma surgeon, that would work for a mechanic, that would work for an infantryman, that would work, you know, you fill in the blank because you know the jobs a lot better than I do, Mike. Mm-hmm. But I think that works for everybody. And it's also that sense of empowerment to know that these are transferable stories that work when I'm trying to figure out what my next phase looks like.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Boil it down to 1 to 2 minutes. Force mm-hmm. yourself to think through that in a competency perspective. And if you're a logistician and you're looking at moving into the logistics space in the private sector, frame it around that. If you're an infantry officer and you're looking at framing it into something around leadership or consulting or whatever the case may be, frame it in that term, right? I think if you know where you want it to go, you can maybe shape that story in a way that has meaning in that industry. But if you try to cut and paste it, so to speak, and have it be the same in every application, you're going to lose it. And just the act of trying to boil it down to 1 to 2 minutes, I think is a really good exercise to go through for a veteran as they formulate what it means for them in the private sector and how they choose to represent themselves. I like that.
You know, at the top of my resume, I have a list of competencies because I have these job titles and duties, but for some people, they're just more interested in what I can do, what I could bring from the standpoint of key areas of expertise or competencies versus titles and, you know,
right.
The types of things I accomplished in that role, that's the past. They want to know what I can do in the future and what I can bring in the future. So, you know, we can be competency focused together, right, on the future. And those are really good conversations. They're uplifting conversations.
Well, I want to be mindful of your time, Janet, and thank you so much for taking that time. Maybe leave us with a sense for what you're doing now with the No Chaff Group, who your client base is, what areas you're looking at operating in, and then how folks can get in touch with you if they're interested in those kinds of services.
Well, as evident from our conversation, there are some existing projects I'm working on, but I'm also very open to working with groups who want to find what their mission is, how to accomplish it, and how we can build a robust team. There are several of us in the consulting community who believe that we are a lot stronger together and we're better together. So that's why it's called No Chaff Group. Build the right talent for the right tasks. And sometimes we need to do that without a prescribed notion of what that looks like. I'm, as I mentioned, working in the rural mental health space and some conversations there. I continue to do pro bono work with the Women Managing the Farm Initiative in Kansas. That has been a really special initiative for 15 years, and I'm pleased to still be a part of that group. Additionally, high level, you know, rural brand management, reputation management, advocacy strategy, are certainly areas that I can help, whether it's a not-for-profit, for-profit, NGO. Those are the areas where we're having great conversations. You know, and I think as we look toward the future of agriculture, ag tech continues to be a topic in virtually every conversation. And it's interesting, ag tech is often alongside of regenerative agriculture. So I think those are really really great spaces to be today. Beyond that, I've got background in rural infrastructure as well. So continuing to have those conversations.
Yeah, maybe there'll be a part two on rural infrastructure and communications, because I know that's a considerable issue when it comes to the employment of ag tech.
It is, and it's critically important. You know, my family lives 8 miles. My parents live 8 miles from a major university town, and they are just getting reliable broadband this year.
2021.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, my grandfather helped to establish the Rural Electric Cooperative in that area, and I grew up understanding, you know, the stranded mile, the importance of the last mile. And I have a neighbor who won't be served by the grant that's helping put that infrastructure in place. And my hope is there'll be another grant that helps reach that connectivity to them. Yeah. It is so critically important. And if we can't serve homes, how are we ever going to serve precision agriculture and ag tech?
It was interesting to hear Janet describe some of their progressive use of, quote, ag tech on their dairy growing up, from four-wheel drive pickups taking the place of tractors in some instances, magnetic feeders for cattle feeding, and even the use of consumer data as a benefit to the producer to help them in getting their product to market faster. Our expectations of ag tech have certainly changed, but as Janet notes, the fundamental need for that tech to create value for the user is certainly still front and center. Janet strikes me as someone with a public service background who doesn't hide behind the unknowns. As she notes in her story about her experiences following 9/11, she was influenced by a mentor who told her to expect the whole story on an issue and to not allow dark corners or unanswered questions. I think this need to look at an issue from all sides is something Janet has brought forward with her through her years in ag and now into her own consulting practice. On multiple occasions, she described this idea of pathway creation, from solving ag labor issues and helping veterans find work, even to guiding her through her struggles with breast cancer. It was an outlook that I think will serve Janet well as she embarks on her next path with No Chaff Group. We wish her the best of luck. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these stories and insights, please leave us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website at agdconsult.com. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Dessau, and until next time, stay frosty.